Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Jack was lying in his bed, deep into a beer-induced sleep. The previous night, he, along with Sal, had been a part of a large group that went into Haverhill for a night on the town. The group consisted of all four officers from Brolin's crew, Leslie's crew, and Parnell's crew. Joining them was Paul Ayers, the co-pilot from Tailwinders, along with his pilot, Playboy, as he ended up being called. Hillhouse and Benson later joined them. As the group continued to gain momentum, they grew in size. Halfway through the night, Ronnie from Hellfire, along with his co-pilot, Jeremy Hayhoe, Tango, and Bill Davies of Bad Penny joined the gang. All in all, 20-some officers went bar hopping from one end of Haverhill to the other. One of the more memorable moments of the evening was watching Parnell's bombardier, Nicholas, who was less than 6 hours released from the hospital, put a knife through his ring finger, playing a game of a five-finger fillet. Parnell's navigator, Grant, ended up taking the intoxicated Nick to get fixed up at a British medical station almost a mile away. It was an event that Jack was surprised by how little he and his friends were concerned for Nick. If this would have happened just 3 months ago, Jack would have panicked and would have nearly fainted at the sight of so much blood. But now, it didn't even faze him. At the end of the night, based off of Jack's blurry memory, he and Parnell had a fun time riding back to base as they sung show tunes and drunkenly improvised their own songs. By the time Jack returned to his hut, Brolin and the rest of his men were already in their beds or close to their beds asleep, Sheila being the only one who fell asleep on the floor between his bed and O'Brien's bed. 4 hours had passed since then, and just as the men were enjoying their much-needed rest, an officer walked in, lit his ceremonial cigarettes, and handed one to Jack, Sal, and Timothy before leaving. Since Timothy hadn't gone drinking, he woke up instantly and was immediately chipper and ready to complete another mission. At the mess hall, Jack, Sal, and Timothy sat with Hillhouse's crew and Ronnie's crew, both of which were still recovering from their hangovers as well. Benson's hangover was so bad that he nearly considered calling in sick and getting someone to replace him today, but he remembered that he could sleep during assembly and would feel much better once he had coffee in his stomach and had a nice hit off the oxygen tank. Ronnie somehow looked normal and ready to take on what the day had ready for him, despite the fact that he nearly drank a whole bottle of Irish whiskey by himself and 5 glasses of scotch just 6 to 7 hours before. Even Sal was shocked by how normal Ronnie seemed. His co-pilot, Heyho, didn't touch a single drink the entire night, but kept up with the rest of the men, to the point that it wasn't until their 4th pub stop that they realized that Heyho was as sober as a judge. This was evident as Heyho was awake, alert, talkative, and witty at 5 in the morning. The breakfast that morning was a hearty serving of maple breakfast sausage, real scrambled eggs, breakfast potatoes, prepared by Marshy's friend Shitbird, who was on kitchen duty that morning, and a nice choice of either coffee, hot chocolate, or tea. As Jack dug into his above-average breakfast, he began to look around the room and started to feel a bit worried about the day's possible mission. The entire mess hall was filled to the brim, and they were having a subpar breakfast. This all pointed to the possibility of a large-scale, dangerous, and costly mission. The briefing hut was full to the point of airmen having to stand along the side walls and stand in the back of the room because there wasn't an available seat in the space. Jack, who normally would be sitting closer to the stage, was forced to be seated towards the back. Looking up at the board, the 300th will be flying the low wing of the 8th group. This was going to be a huge mission. 8 or more groups means that over 500 B-17s were going to be flying in today's mission. The last time they had this many bombers assigned to fly, it was to Berlin. This was not looking good. Looking up at the board again, Jack saw that the 530th Squadron would be flying the high squadron of the little group, with the 531st Squadron flying as the lead and the 529th flying as the low squadron. Leading the 530th today would be Burke and his crew of Stormy Knight, which, according to Leslie, was a slap in the face to men like him, Ronnie, and Jack, since Burke was less experienced than even men like Hill House, but was more than likely picked because the boss wanted to make a point that Burke, his friend, was the only officer in the 530th that he trusted to lead other than himself. The rest of the formation went as follows. Leslie and Bob McGee flying to Burke's right in the number 2 spot, Ronnie and Hellfire from above flying in the number 3 spot, Hill House and Dropping Deuces flying in the number 4 spot, Jack and the rest of Loadable flying off Hill House's right in the number 5 spot, Playboy and the rest of Tailwinders flying off Hill House's left in the number 6 spot, and finally, the rookie crew of The Spirit of Billy Mitchell flying in the backup number 7 spot. Again, all of this was all proof that something big was underway. The biggest question of all was, who would Jack be flying with today? The boss, as far as Jack was concerned, was still grounded for medical reasons, although he and the rest of the 530th had no idea what that entailed or when he would be back to flying status, because they hadn't seen him or heard from him in several days. The rumor was that he had hit his head in some accident or some fall, but everyone took that with a grain of salt. As Jack began talking to Luther Wertheim from Dropping Deuces, Jack heard a voice call to him that Jack immediately recognized. Looking behind him, he saw Parnell walking down the aisle of the briefing room and soon arrived at the end of Jack's row. "What are you doing here?" Jack asked. "I'm flying with you today, Louie," Parnell replied with a smirk on his face. Jack, not knowing what to say, just sat in confusion. Guessing what Jack was more than likely thinking, Parnell explained, "You were assigned some replacement pilot from the 528th squad, and I was set to fly with some new crew, so I switched him so I could fly with you and your guys. You can thank me later. I'm gonna go find a place to sit now. I'll catch up with you later." Jack raised a thumbs up to Parnell, and as he did so, a huge smile broke out onto his face. "That was nice of him," mentioned Benson, having heard the conversation. As Jack began talking with Benson, that's when the noise of the room halted as Colonel Poole entered the room. Arriving at the stage and ordering the men to sit down, the Colonel began his monologue. "Gentlemen, as you probably have already figured out by the size of the formation and the amount of airmen chosen for the sortie, we are headed to a big target for today." At this, the room slightly groaned and moaned, and the knot in Jack's stomach began tightening. "Today, gentlemen, is another large and monumental day for us in which our efforts will help bring the war to an end just a little bit faster. I would just like to say that I have faith in each and every single one of you that you can complete the task at hand and return back with glory and honor." Colonel Poole looked over at Captain Burnett and gave him the nod, letting him know to pull the curtain back. Once he did, he called out over the sounds of groans, "Berlin, gentlemen, we're going back to Berlin." We'll be right back. Less than a minute later, May 6th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0600. Jack's heart felt like it had dropped, and he began to sweat heavily. Looking over at Sal and Timothy, Jack had no idea how in the world these two rookie crew members were going to handle Berlin. It was a miracle that he and the rest of Little Bull made it through their first mission to Berlin. He doubted that he was going to get lucky twice. Looking forward, Jack could see the shoulders of Hill House and his crew slouch forward as they listened to Colonel Poole trying to regain control of the room of airmen who were making it very known of what they thought about this mission. On the way out of the hut, Parnell met up with Jack and the two began complaining, Jack more so than Parnell, since Jack knew what to expect. The mission today was going to be the largest that the 300th had ever been a part of. Over 1,000 B-17s and B-24s would be split up into three waves, each wave made up of five groups, or 270 plus bombers. The 300th would be flying in a second wave, heading to bomb a communications building outside Tempelhof Airfield in Berlin. The escorts today were plenty, four squadrons of P-51 Mustangs and two squadrons of P-47 Thunderbolts. One thing was certain for Jack, and that was the fact that he was happy at the fact that Parnell would be flying with him and the rest of Little Bull today. Having to fly to Berlin the second time with an unknown rookie pilot, replacement pilot, or, worst of all, having to fly it with the boss again, would add another layer of stress to an already stressful day. Upon arriving at the troop truck, Jack could see that the men of his crew had already learned where they were going. In fact, when Jack arrived, he heard Mills explaining to both Muth and Marshy about how bad Berlin was and what to expect. Listening in were the enlisted men from Hellfire from Above. One of the men in that group was Johnny C. Johnny C looked more sick in the face than any of the other men did, and no one blamed him. The last time he flew over Berlin, more than half of his friends and crew members were slaughtered before his very eyes, and he himself sustained a bad injury, which sent him back to the hospital after just coming from a month-long recovery there. Muth, of course, didn't seem bothered by his crew members' warnings, and Marshy seemed more than eager to claim a Nazi fighter kill for himself and to watch the Big B burn. As Jack, Parnell, Sal, and Timothy got themselves in the back of the truck, Ronnie, Hey-Ho, Jim Appleton, and Einstein arrived, and the group was on their way to the plane. Pulling up to their hard stand, expecting to see another replacement plane like for Mother and Country, Jack was astonished to see Little Bull sitting pretty and patched up, nose pointing right at them. Standing behind the left wing was Butch and one of the mechanics looking over the underside of the wing. As soon as Butch saw Jack, he parted himself and walked under the wing and arrived at Jack's position.
Butch, you son of a bitch, she looks amazing.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get her back in the air where she belongs.
But, like, how? How did you manage to keep her out of the scrapyard or becoming a hangar queen?
Oh, she wasn't that bad. But I did have to pull a few strings, though. I practically had to beg Burns myself to not make her into a hangar queen. I said, listen, she flew back to England completely fine. She landed completely fine. And, despite the fact that she needed some cosmetic... It was a lot more than that, but she was still flyworthy. I must have done a really good job because he okayed it, and, well, we did the best we could.
Putting his hand on Butch's shoulder, Jack thanked Butch for his hard work and dedication. Butch, keeping with his attitude, politely shrugged it off and walked Jack through the extent of his repairs while Parnell went into the cockpit and did the pre-flight checklist. In the back of the plane, Mills went to open the side door of the Bull and pulled himself inside. Looking immediately towards the tail section, Mills began hearing the screams of Pally along with the sounds of rushing winds. Mills knew that it was all in his head and quickly turned his head towards the front of the plane and moved his body towards his compartment, trying to keep his mind occupied by looking over his equipment. After Beans entered into the waste compartment, Muth was next. He moved his way through the waste compartment and into the radio room. The room had a foul smell to it, one that he didn't recognize. The wooden floor panel beneath his feet was stained red, and all over it were small holes or wooden patches drilled into the floor. Muth's immediate thought was of how much of a tripping hazard these patches were. Turning around to ask Tommy, who he heard standing by his turret, Muth saw Tommy glaring at the blood-stained floor with a look of sadness. Muth never bothered asking what happened to the former radio man and their crew, and after seeing the blood-soaked floor, Muth didn't want to. After the checklists were done, that's when Jack ordered all the men to meet him down below the nose compartment. Once down there, Jack had the men huddled up, and he proceeded to run the men through the day's mission, with Parnell helping him. Jack couldn't help but be reminded of his first mission. He had relived that first mission huddle so many times in his head over the last 2 months that he felt like he had somehow physically stepped back into time and was now in that memory. The only difference was the weather was warmer by 20 degrees. The grass was a luscious green instead of a lifeless brown. Jack was now leading the huddle instead of the boss, and more than half the faces of the crew were different. As Jack finished up his speech, that's when Parnell looked down at his watch and saw that they just had 2 minutes until the mission started. Bringing Jack's attention to this, Jack wrapped up his briefing, and the men all got inside their plane and prepared for takeoff. About 2 hours and 15 minutes later, the 300th was now 21,000 feet above the English coastal city of Great Yarmouth, heading towards the German coast. With Jack seated in the pilot seat and Parnell sitting in the co-pilot seat, the two pilots kept the bomber in its position, and everything was going as smooth as what could be expected, when suddenly, Jack heard the engine hum change, meaning one of the four engines was out of sync for some reason. Looking down, the throttles and oil mixtures hadn't been changed. Nothing had been changed. Looking down at the control panel, that's when Jack saw that the number two engine was slowly losing power. Pointing it out to Parnell, Jack then called Willie in to help look over the controls and identify the problem. As the next few minutes passed, with Parnell and Willie all trying to troubleshoot the issue, the number two engine died and the propeller was arriving at a stationary position. After feathering the engine, Jack saw the formation slowly drifting away from them as Little Bull began to slow down. Jack and Parnell attempted to push the throttles of the other three engines up as far as they would go, so they would have as much power as possible to keep up with the formation as they continued running through the possible solutions. Unfortunately, the other three engines were getting dangerously close to overheating, and Jack made the conscious decision to abort the mission and take his crew back to Thurlow.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them, they're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canto 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you, because you can.
You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force from World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. 35 minutes later, Lota Bull arrived back at Thurlow and safely made it back onto the ground and were taxiing back to their hard stand. Once they arrived and cut their engines, the men of the Bull exited the plane, all of them feeling a mixture of relief and frustration. Tommy, for example, felt relief that he wouldn't have to fly over the heavily defended Berlin, but at the same time he was frustrated that he had to wake up early, get dressed in all the layers of flight clothes, gather his equipment, mentally prepare himself for hell, and it was all for nothing. Not to mention, his friends, such as Mason Pointers, were all going to be flying over hell with one less plane to cover them and shield them. It was a feeling that everybody was wearing on their faces, with the exception of Muth. As Jack exited the bomber, that's when Butch approached him and asked what happened. Jack and Parnell proceeded to explain what happened to Butch, and as they did, that's when the boss pulled up in a Jeep, much to the surprise of every crew member of the Bull. Jack, being the only one that didn't notice the boss arriving, continued telling Butch about what occurred, but was cut off when the boss called out, "Lieutenant Miller, can I speak to you for a moment? I'm filling my mechanic in on why I had to abort the mission today, so we can get it fixed," replied Jack. "I can see that, but you have a pilot standing right next to you that can do that. And he, after all, was with you when the entire event happened, correct?" Jack looked over at Parnell with a look of disbelief. However, Parnell whispered back, "Just go. I'll talk to Butch." Jack sighed and looked back at the boss and began walking over to his parked Jeep. The airman watched the boss as he looked over his former crew and former plane, with the duality of both pride and angst in his face. Jack arrived at the boss from the driver's side of the Jeep, and that's when the boss said to him, "Get in." "What?" "I said, get in. I'll take you to the debriefing hut." "But what about my crew?" "Parnell's with them. He's your friend after all. You trust him to get your crew to the debriefing hut?" "I do, but..." "Okay, then, get in then. I just don't understand why I have to go be debriefed when we didn't even make it across the channel." "Well, there's a lot of things you don't seem to understand, Jack. And that's why you are in the predicament that you're in. Now get in the Jeep and tell your crew that you will meet them at the debriefing hut." Jack was filled with more fear and anxiety over this moment than he had been about flying a mission to Berlin. He looked over at his men and then told them that he would meet up with them at the debriefing hut. And then he made his way over to the passenger seat of the Jeep, put his flight bag in the back of it, and then hopped in. Just as Jack's butt hit the seat, the boss threw the Jeep into gear and took off, with the men of the Bull, Parnell and Butch, watching Jack drive away, going in the complete opposite direction of the debriefing hut. In the Jeep, Jack looked and saw that they were driving along the perimeter track, heading towards the opposite end of the airfield. "Where are you taking me?" Jack asked. "I'm going the long way. We need to talk."
"About what?"
"What did you tell Butch happened today?"
"I told him that our number 2 engine had shit the bed and we lost power when we hit 21,000 feet.
"Okay, is that it?"
"Yeah, because that's what happened."
"Oh, no. The boss said, cutting off Jack.
"What the hell is that supposed to mean?"
retorted Jack.
"That's what you told them happened. And that's the story that you're going to try to feed the brass. Because you think that you're smarter than them and that they'll buy your story."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"Look, we both know the real reason why you aborted that mission, Jack."
"I'm not sure we do."
"Do not be cute with me. You got your best friend to share the cockpit with you today once you found out that you were going to be on a big mission. And then, once you found out that it was Berlin, you and your best friend got together, I'm sure conspired together, to fake a faulty engine failure, and bada bing, bada boom, you successfully took yourself out of the mission. Congrats to you. However, you should know that they're going to be interrogating you and Parnell, as well as the rest of your crew, about why you had to abort, and they're going to poke holes in your story, and I'm not going to stop them from coming down on you and Parnell. Boss, do you hear yourself? Everything you're saying is complete insanity. No, it's not. It's the truth. It's not the truth. What is your problem? I mean, did you lose all sense when you hit your head? No, I know you. And this is the kind of thing that you would try to pull. That's a complete lie, boss, and you know that. Listen, Jack, you are a coward. You always have been. Simple as that. You were a coward on our first mission to Berlin. You sat there and let me take the controls. And you have always sat aside and let others take control. And yet, you think that I would take control by staging an entire engine failure just to get out of flying a mission to Berlin. Yeah, your theory makes complete sense. It does, because you're incapable, Jack, of doing the right thing. I've found you the best pilot for your crew, and you choose Parnell, your best friend. That was Parnell's choice, not mine. If you don't believe me, go ahead and ask him yourself. They'll tell you. I don't need to. I already know the truth, Jack. You apparently don't know. Listen to yourself for a moment. None of it's true, and I know you know what's a lie. Enough discussion, Lieutenant Miller. You can relay your story to the brass, and I'll let them figure it out. Fine. I will gladly talk to them. They at least will have enough sense to know the difference between a lie and the truth. Oh, I can tell the difference, Jack. Apparently not. You would think that a man like yourself would know a lie when he is one. The boss slammed on his brakes just before arriving at the main hangars on the western end of the airfield. Pennsylvania Avenue was now less than 300 yards away. Jack watched as the boss continued looking ahead as he muttered, "What was that, Lieutenant?" It was in this moment that Jack knew that he had to do what he had to do. He knew what this conversation was going to lead to, and he knew that he was backed into a corner and that it was the boss who had put him here. And despite Jack trying to take the high road again and again and again, he knew that he had to protect his crew and he had to protect himself. "You heard me," Jack replied. Slowly turning to look at Jack, the boss responded back with, "You're done. You hear me? You're done. You say anything, and I swear to you." "What, Jack? What are you going to do?" "I'll make sure every officer in the 300th knows about Catherine." The boss's heart nearly stopped. His eyes locked onto Jack's face. The veins in his neck began to swell up as he was filling up with rage. "Oh, you thought that secret died with Andy? Well, guess what, it didn't. Now, I've debated doing this for quite some time, but after today, you have left me with no other choice. You call me a coward? How is this for cowardly? I know that you are on thin ice with Colonel Poole, and your Brunswick stunt, mixed with your recent head injury, has many of the officers in the 530th skeptical of your mental stability. Hell, even Burke has suspicions about you. He was talking about it just the other night after he had too much to drink at the officers' club. All it would take is for me to blabber to either Coca, Brolin, or really any one of the officers in the 530th, and you know what would happen next." As Jack talked, the boss couldn't believe what he was hearing. How on earth could Jack use his dead wife as blackmail against him? He was even more of a monster than what he had given him credit for. "Boss, I don't know what your problem is with me. You already apologized, and then as fast as you apologized, you went right back to hating me. You know, I've spent many a night thinking that maybe that after losing your wife and everything that you knew, that you needed someone to blame and hate. Now, I don't know, but What I do know is this. A week ago, if you would have told people the truth about Catherine, it wouldn't have mattered. Nobody would have cared. But in your attempts at trying to keep that secret hidden and trying to project yourself as this no-nonsense fearless leader, you have done more damage to how people see you, and you have given everyone around you a reason to question you. As Hill House once told me, fear causes itself to come true. So, I'm going to get out of the Jeep now, and I'm going to walk to the debriefing hut where my crew is waiting for me. And I'm going to tell the upper brass what really happened. And nothing is going to happen to either one of us. Got it? The boss, gritting his teeth, responded, "You son of a bitch. No one's going to believe you." Jack, keeping full eye contact with the boss as he slowly got out of the Jeep, grabbed his bag and replied, "You can test that assumption at your earliest convenience, Captain." The boss quickly hit the gas pedal and drove away, leaving Jack standing on the perimeter track. Watching the boss drive away, Jack didn't feel victorious or cathartic. He felt gross, dishonorable, and abysmal. Another piece of his innocence was now gone. He had gone a step further into becoming a different person, a person that he wasn't familiar with, a person that he would have hated just a few months ago. But at the same time, Jack knew that the boss was the one who had put him in this position and where he had to resort to doing such a dirty thing. If the boss had done his job, a lot of grief would have been saved. Brunswick wouldn't have happened. Rosie, Andy, Pally, Skimpy, Bernhausen, and many others would still be here. This was all ramifications of the boss's actions, not Jack's. Jack simply did what he had to do. As Jack walked back to Pennsylvania Avenue, he tried to get his mind off the boss and tried to focus his mind on the time, trying to guess where his friends were on their mission, hoping that they made it through okay. At the debriefing, Jack had walked through the entire day's events with the officer assigned to take Jack's testimony. Parnell and Willie both gave additional testimonies about the events. The entire time Jack's crew was getting questioned, the boss stood in the back corner of the hut, watching and listening in on the debriefing. As Parnell and Willie shared their testimonies, Jack made sure to give the boss a few glances, each one Jack seeing the level of aggravation growing on the boss's face. After only 8 minutes of interrogation, the officer in charge of the debriefing thanked the men for their information and excused them. As the crew stood up, the boss walked over to the officer and began whispering to him. Jack noticed this and looked directly at the boss, trying to figure out what was going on. It didn't take long for Jack to realize that the officer was shrugging the incident off as an abort mission due to mechanical failure, a pretty common occurrence in the 8th Air Force. This assumption was backed up more when he saw the look on the boss's face sour into a look of confusion and even more frustration. Jack then turned around and walked out of the hut with his crew, and once they were outside, Parnell asked Jack, "What was all of that about?" "What?" Jack responded. "The thing with the boss. Him just pulling up and taking you away and then dumping you off at the hangars," Parnell clarified. "Yeah, not to mention the looks that you guys were giving each other at the debriefing hut," Sal added. "Yeah, I noticed that too," Willie commented. "Look, there's a lot of history between us fellas, I can assure you. It's all worked out. There's nothing to worry about," defended Jack. "If you say so, Jack, I don't know though," Parnell added as the group made their way over to the equipment hut to get changed out of their flight clothes. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast.
If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. Jack was sitting with Parnell outside the officers' club, waiting for the formation to come in. Judging by the time, the formation would be arriving at any moment now. Parnell and Jack were both talking about life back home when Slim Jim arrived and joined in the conversation. As the men talked, Jack began wondering what the boss was doing now. He wondered what was going through his head. Once he took the time to pause, reflect, and process all that had just happened, would he realize of how much of a controlling ass that he had been to Jack? Would he realize the scale of disaster that he had caused for men like Jack, or his former crew, or even members of his own squadron? None of that mattered now. Jack did what he had to do, even though he was bothered by it and still felt ashamed for doing what he did. He now had the boss off his back, which gave him some comfort. The only question that now stood was, who was the boss going to permanently assign to pilot and lead the Bull? Up to this point, the reason the boss was being so controlling of the Bull was because the boss's name, as he thought, was synonymous with the Bull, and if Jack, Timothy, or Sal were the slightest bit below par, then he felt it would reflect negatively against him. However, now that Jack made it clear to the boss that his reputation has already been soiled and tarnished, there was no longer a need for him to be so controlling. However, that would be assuming that the boss took what Jack said to heart, and that he was in his right state of mind to understand this reality. As Jack continued to ponder these thoughts, that's when they saw people rushing towards the airfield. Knowing what this meant, Jack, Parnell, and Slim Jim quickly got off their chairs and headed towards the airfield. Once there, Jack could see the formation approaching Thurlow. What he saw gutted him. Only 10 planes of the 21 planes that took off from Thurlow that morning returned. The entire 529th Squadron was gone, and two planes were missing from the 531st Squadron. Of the 530th Squadron, the rookie crew of the Spirit of Billy Mitchell and the crew of Tailwinders were missing. Of the six returning bombers from the 530th, nearly every returning bomber shot off a red flare, requesting an emergency landing. Since the 530th was flying in the High Squadron, they were scheduled to land first. The first plane that landed was Bomb McGee. Leslie landed with large holes punched into the left wing, one of which was big enough for a full-grown man to fit through, just to the left of the number one engine. Bomb McGee also had several bullet holes in her nose, two of which led to the reason Leslie called for the plane to land. Their bombardier, First Lieutenant Robert Perez, lost his left foot when a bullet hit his ankle, and he took bullet fragments to his face when a bullet hit his 50 caliber nose gun. Unfortunately, Bomb McGee had bullet holes and flak holes littering her radio compartment, waist compartment, and tail compartment. Both of their waist gunners were hit and killed instantly from fighter attacks, and their tail gunner was killed when a flak shell went off right in front of them. Strips of ripped canvas off the horizontal stabilizers reflected the condition of the dead gunner's body slumped inside the tiny gunner's compartment. Jack, Parnell, and a bunch of other airmen all rushed to try and aid Bomb McGee as it landed on the eastern end of runway 2 and rolled off into the grass, coming to a stop not far from where their hardstand was located. Seeing over 50 airmen, grounds crewmen, paramedics, and other personnel swarming Bomb McGee, Jack looked over at another B-17 coming into land. It was hellfire from above. Jack called Parnell and the others to help aid whoever was injured on board Ronnie's plane, and soon, Ronnie touched down on the eastern end of runway 2 and rolled off into the grass, stopping just shy of 120 feet away from the control tower. This caused even a bigger group of men to swarm around the wounded bomber. The damage to Hellfire was even worse than Bomb McGee. The entire nose cone was missing. The left side cheek gun window had been shot out. A 50 caliber gun was left hanging out of the window, suspended by a single cable. Bullet holes and flak holes riddled the bomb bay, the left wing, and a large section of the left flap was missing, as well as the section of wing over top of the flap. Hellfire's tail had a 20mm cannon shell hole located right at its base. Since Jack Parnell, Slim Jim, and a few others were the first ones to arrive at Ronnie's plane, they were more informed as to the severity of the situation. Their left waist gunner had been killed by fighters. Their other waist gunner had been hit in the back, but luckily his flak vest took most of the hit, and he only had 3 broken ribs and a slipped disc. In the nose, things were bad. While over the target, a flak shell went off just a few feet in front of Hellfire's nose cone, killing Jim Appleton instantly, while damaging the flight controls and maiming Einstein, who was now screaming in agony from inside the nose compartment. Jack asked why Einstein was still left the nose compartment, having had 150-mile-an-hour winds blasting him for several hours as he made it back to England. Ronnie pointed to the nose hatch and said, "Hop in and see for yourself." While Jack hesitated, Parnell flipped himself up inside Hellfire, and soon Jack followed him in order to assist in lowering Einstein down to the incoming paramedics. Once Jack entered the nose compartment, the sight was worse than what Jack could have ever imagined. All over the inside of the nose compartment was frozen blood, bits of flesh, articles of clothing and equipment, all from Jim Appleton, on top of the extensive damage done by the flak burst. Looking down lay the butchered body of Einstein. His right leg was nearly severed at the kneecap. His tendons were among the only thing keeping the bottom half of his leg attached to his thigh. His left leg had significant chunks taken from it. Stuck to the back of his kneecap was a small piece of metal, which was causing a tremendous amount of pain, as well as the hundreds of metal splinters that were stuck all over the right side of his body. What disturbed Jack more than anything was the look of utter despair, panic, and pain in Einstein's face as he screamed. Jack peered his head through the blown open gun cheek window and asked Ronnie if Einstein had any morphine. Ronnie dreadfully shook his head and told Jack that he would have loved to, but all the morphine in their first aid kits on board the plane had been stolen. Jack then turned back into the blown open nose compartment and saw Parnell getting into position, trying to move Einstein. However, as Jack and Parnell attempted to move him, his screams grew even louder. Finally, a paramedic called for the two airmen to hop down out of the bomber and allow the paramedics to move him. With blood now covering Jack and Parnell's shoes, knees, and hands, the two jumped down from the nose hatch, and as the paramedics attempted to lower Einstein down, Jack asked the shell-shocked Hey-Ho and the visibly upset Ronnie what happened on the mission today. Ronnie explained that when they arrived at their fourth waypoint, which was over Germany, the first wave drifted off course, while the second wave, the one the 300th was flying in, stayed on course. That's when the fighters arrived and tore into the formation. Then, when they got to the decision point, the third wave got lost, and the second wave went into Berlin all alone and got destroyed by flak. That's when a majority of the planes in the 300th got hit. Ronnie did say that Tailwinders in the Spirit of Billy Mitchell fell behind and weren't shot down, but kept radio contact all the way until they got to the coast of England, and the signal just went bad, meaning either they were really far behind or they ditched the channel. This was good news. Soon, Einstein was lowered out of the hatch and put on a stretcher, and despite having been given a shot of morphine from one of the paramedics, Einstein continued screaming. Among the screams was what sounded like words. Listening closely to it, Jack could make out the words "kill" and "please." That's when Jack realized Einstein was screaming out, "Kill me, please," through his strained voice. As the paramedics took Einstein over to the ambulance to load him up, Ronnie and a few others followed him, trying to give whatever comfort they could. Jack stood in shock, trying to process what he had just saw and heard.
Before Jack could take any more time to process, that's when he heard the commotion coming over from dropping deuces, which had just landed and come to a full stop about 50 yards away from where Jack was standing. Seeing Parnell and a few others run towards deuces, Jack made a beeline over to his friend's bomber. Dropping deuces was shot up in the nose, both from bullets and flak. Blood was splattered on the nose cone of deuces. Bullet holes and flak holes infested Deuce's radio room and waste compartment. Worst of all was their ball turret was blown open. Only the back section, the part inside the bomber, was left. From the outside, the turret looked like a half of a cracked open egg. Andrew and splattered remains covered the inside. Looking over at Hill House, Jack saw that he was visibly shaking up. Benson's eyes were bloodshot and welling up with tears, his face drenched in a nervous sweat. Towards the back of the plane, Jack saw members of his crew huddled around someone. That's when Jack heard Hill House relay the information to the group. Dropping deuces took 3 close call flak hits over the target. One sent shrapnel into the nose, killing the bombardier instantly, and the other 2 went off at the same time, one above the radio room and the other under the plane. Both flak shells killed the ball turret gunner and the radio operator. After the bomb run, the formation got swarmed by fighters, which tore into the nose compartment and cockpit, killing Luther Wertheim instantly and destroying Deuce's hydraulic system. In that same fighter attack, their tail gunner, Hick, as he was referred to, was also killed when a bullet made contact with his head. Shortly after that, Terrence Mercier, the top turret gunner, was hit by a bullet fragment in his head, blinding him and knocking him unconscious. The entire trip home, Attila and Mason Pointers watched over Terrence, and they were there to see their crew member wake up from his head injury, drooling and murmuring. He sustained horrific brain damage, and even as they carted Terrence off, he was still in a confused, non-cognizant state, unable to move or respond to commands. Jack looked back again at his crew members huddled around both Mason Pointers and Attila as they each mentally broke down, their brains having trouble processing the hell they just endured. As the planes continued coming into land, Jack, Parnell, and many others helped with unloading the wounded and dead from the rest of the 300th. It would be found out later that Tailwinders had made an emergency belly landing at an American fighter airfield just off the coast. Everyone on board was safe, and the crew sustained no deaths or injuries. The same could not be said about the rookie crew of the Spirit of Billy Mitchell. They landed at an RAF field just off the English coast and nearly crashed the plane, it was so damaged. Their number 2 and 3 engines were dead. Their number 3 engine caught fire and flames tore into the plane's horizontal stabilizer, as well as badly burned up the waste gunner. The radio operator arrived at the RAF field hanging on by a thread. Their other waste gunner had been killed from flak, and their tail gunner was recovering from a bad case of frostbite. All in all, close to half the 300th was lost, killed, or injured on one mission to Berlin. Among the planes that went down in the 529th Squadron, one of them was being piloted by the 529th Squadron commander, Captain Fagan, who went down with his plane over the target after a flak shell severed their right wing from the fuselage. It was one of the bloodiest missions the 300th had ever flown, and Jack felt guilty that he wasn't there to share the sufferings of his fellow officers. That night, Jack was sitting at the officers' club with Parnell, Slim Jim, Tango, Bill Davies, and Sal. The officers' club wasn't full of airmen trying to drown themselves in their sorrows in liquid refreshment, which Jack found odd. Usually after a tough mission, nearly every man on the airfield would head to the club to drink, and they would stagger back to their huts and pass out there. Jack had done this himself a time or two. Could it be that so many men barely had the will or enough energy to walk their way to the officers' club? As Jack sat among his friends, the topic of conversation changed to Ronnie and Hill House. Tango asked if Ronnie or Hill House was going to be okay after what happened to the crew today. Parnell was the first one to speak.
You know, guys, I, to be honest, I have no idea. You know, Ronnie was already hanging on by a thread since he had lost his co-pilot, and he's had all but one of his crew members killed in action or taken out of action. And with Hill House, I know what it's like to have your entire crew murdered in a single day. And it's discouraging and it's disheartening. We'll just have to see how they take it, you know? Jack agreed and lifted up his beer to cheer us to that. But before anyone could drink their beers, that's when an officer walked in the club and announced,
"They got the guy! They got the guy who's been stealing the morphine! He's in the showers!"
As the officer left, Jack looked at his buddies in confusion, and soon everyone gulped their drinks and hurled themselves out of the club, heading towards the showers. Once there, Jack couldn't believe what he was seeing. Men were all huddled around an officer who was tied to a wooden chair, his face pouring out with blood. One by one, Jack watched as airmen walked up to the man and launched their fists into his head and face, all while the crowd cheered. Jack was horrified at the sight. He had seen too much blood today, and this was a different kind of violence and horror than he had ever seen before. Looking over to Coca, who was getting ready to take his turn, Jack asked,
"How do we know it's this guy?"
"Because we fucking saw him shooting up in here."
"Who is he?"
"I don't know, Louie. What the fuck are you asking for? He's some fucking pisshead from the 531st Squadron. You happy now? What, you want to know where he went to college?"
"No, I just, I don't... I think this is a bit too much."
"Not to me,"
Coca said before walking up to the man, kicking his shoulder, and then sending his right fist right into the man's mouth, knocking a tooth loose. The crowd went haywire over this. Coca returned to the crowd, and Jack looked even more horrified.
"What's the matter, Louie?"
I can't watch this."
"So don't. Let the men handle this."
Jack paused and looked at the bloodied man's face, and in that moment, Jack tried to sympathize with the man. What drives someone to shoot morphine into his body consistently? What kinds of things has this man seen or felt that the only thing that could numb his pain or wash away the sorrow was injecting morphine into his body? This could have been Parnell, Ronnie, or Hill House. Hell, it could have been Jack, easily. This man was simply not a monster. He was nothing but the result of what war does to people. In this case, this man's crime was that his way of coping with what everyone else was experiencing had affected the entire 300th and had caused hordes of men to suffer enormous amounts of physical pain. It was also in that moment that Jack understood why the crowd was doing what they were doing. These men needed an enemy that they could fight. They had been strapped into the inside of their fortresses while the German Luftwaffe and German flak guns pounded them into a bloodied mess, mission after mission. Pilots like Jack never got the chance to fire a gun at the enemy that was causing them so much heartache, and so this addict, this officer, was the substitution for the awful and relentless enemy that they were unable to strap to a chair and dish out what had been done to them week after week. As Jack pondered all of this, Coca couldn't help but notice Jack's face. Seeing the little bit of innocence left in Jack made Coca realize the severity of what they were doing. Looking back at the bloodied officer, Coca took in a deep breath, called for the crowd to halt their attacks, and stated that the man had suffered enough. As Coca did so, the bloodied officer began murmuring and moaning the words,
"Fucking just kill me, please, just fucking kill me."
As the officer continued to repeat himself like a broken record, that's when Ronnie, who heard Einstein call out the same line just a few hours before, took out his pistol and pointed it at the officer's head while saying, "I can make that happen." Coca, Heyho, Parnell, and a few others intervened and stood between Ronnie and the officer. Coca then asked Ronnie to lower his weapon and walk away. That's when Parnell replied, "Look at him, Ronnie. Killing him won't solve anything. Leaving him alive is the best way to get even. Let him live with the fact that he was caught and that he'll have to carry the scars of tonight for the rest of his life. Isn't that enough suffering for you?"
Ronnie, hesitating, lowered his pistol and left the shower room. One by one, men began to leave too, some of the men spitting on the officer as he turned to leave. Only Jack, Coca, Parnell, and Slim were left in the room with the bloodied officer. Coca looked over at the men and told them to leave. When asking what Coca was going to do with the bloodied officer, Coca told him that he was planning on taking him and leaving him out by the road. And that's when he turned to the officer and told him that he was to tell whoever found him that he had blacked out and woke up on the side of the road. And if he ever deviated from that story, Coca would make sure Ronnie would see to it that his suffering would only worsen. The officer agreed, and Coca assured the group of men left that the officer would keep quiet. Still feeling skeptical, Jack and Parnell agreed and proceeded to leave the shower room and head back to the officers' club, where they would drink in silence, not only out of reverence for their fallen brothers today, but to figure out how they were going to mentally continue fighting when everything was starting to feel hopeless, endless, and pointless. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. Please leave an honest review on whatever podcast app you're currently listening on. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canto 34 Studios, a DIY project that's helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies of Europe in World War II. I hope we can do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for another episode of Season 2 of Snafu.